close, but you can't grab this.
Hi, Cake Squid listeners. It's Every Other Sunday again. This is Ronnie Lipschitz, and I'm here in the studio with Brooke Wright, and you're listening to Sustainability Now, a bi-weekly Cake Squid radio show focused on environment, sustainability, and social justice in the Monterey Bay region, California, and the world. Our guest today is Fred Keeley, and we're going to talk about oil and water, which don't mix. So Fred is a well-known political person about town and across California and the Monterey Bay region. He has a long and distinguished career in community service locally and statewide. He's served as a member of the County Board of Supervisors. He's been in the Assembly, where he was elected to three terms. He spent 10 years as a Santa Cruz County Treasurer. Today, he's an activist for the environment and housing and other things in the county, on the board of the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary Foundation, for example. He teaches in the San Jose State University MPA program, in the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute, and with Secretary Leon Panetta, he team teaches a Santa Clara Law School class entitled Achieving Consensus in a Partisan Environment, for which I say good luck. I wrote this long introduction, Fred, and then I was going to say, and that's our show for today. but I want to welcome you to Sustainability Now. Brooke and I have been talking about Glasgow and the Conference of the Parties, which is starting, I think, on Tuesday. But we're going to talk about the oceans and I'm wondering, when you were in the Assembly, you were responsible for the passage of several really significant marine-related laws. And maybe you could tell us something about those to start with.
Sure. And again, Ronnie and Brooke, thank you both very much for having me on this evening. And again, my apologies for being late. I was just taken with the downtown trick-or-treat scene. I think a way to look at what I faced 20 years ago in the legislature was this, that California is the only state in the United States that put the Fish and Game Commission in its state constitution when the state was founded. Huh. And you kind of think about that, and that's kind of encouraging in a way. But kind of think about what was the state of fish and game in 1850. The answer is it was plentiful. There were herds on the terrestrial side. There were schools of all kinds of fish on the wet side. And so a way to think about it is the challenge was, how do you manage abundance? And the answer to that question is you don't have to manage much at all. So that's what went on for a long time. And then bit by bit on the terrestrial side, you started seeing herds and species being reduced. You start seeing fracturing of their traditional ways of moving around on the terrestrial side. That is easily observable by everybody. So there started to be more intense management on what I will call the dry side. Yet on the wet side, it continued to look the same. So there was a delay in any kind of management in the fisheries and in the oceans. So along comes the 1970s, 80s, 90s, and there becomes more and more of a focus on the marine environment. And what comes out of that focus is that now the challenge is to manage scarcity, not to manage abundance. The oceans, of course, are suffering from climate change, the acidification. They are the lungs. Every other breath we take, we thank the oceans for it. But it is becoming stressed in its ability to do that. And the species in the ocean are having equal challenges. So what I thought made sense, and it wasn't my idea, frankly, I've never had an original idea in my life, but other people had really good original ideas. And the thoughts were, let's start actively managing the state's coastal waters for purposes of sustainability over time. That's what we're managing towards, sustainability over time. And so a lot of very good minds came together. The bills had my name on them, but it was really the work product of people with very good minds in the ocean science community, in the fishing community, in sport and commercial fishing, in the whale watching world, in just up and down, and all of the coastal dependent economies up and down the coast, who said California's coast is what draws billions of dollars into the tourist environment in California, and that is going to disappear equal to the degree to which the oceans are challenged and people no longer enjoy the experience of the ocean because we've let it go. So that was the impetus of authoring a series of bills that became law. And the short version of what they did is essentially two things, categorically. One is establish a chain of marine protected areas from the California-Mexico coast to the California-Oregon coast. And these are not, some are, but they are not exclusively no-take zones. They are, each one of these, and we have one right here off our Santa Cruz coast, are intended to deal with the entire water column, not with one species, but with one set of scientific facts in an area in the, and that'll help reveal what is the right management plan there with regard to the various species. This has been in place now for 20 years, and the California Ocean Science Trust just published a couple of the How Did It Go reports. And so, folks, if you want to look at those, it's at CaliforniaOceanScienceTrust.org. And they have revealed that the studies have revealed that this is actually working. We are getting species recovery. We are getting species interactions. We are getting area by area a healthier coast all the time. And that's amazing in the context of global climate change, seeing what the challenges are. So, yeah, it seems like some of these things can actually have purchase and really work.
Well, I have a question. The marine sanctuary, the Monterey Bay Marine Sanctuary, was created in 1992, right? That didn't accomplish the goals of the legislation. Can you explain the difference there? Or the relationship between the sanctuary and your legislation?
Sure. So the sanctuary was federal. It was in when Leon Panetta, he was our congressman, for quite a while, but in his last year, right before the Clinton administration started, and he became director of the Office of Management and Budget and then chief of staff of the president and so on, in his last year representing us in Congress, he had an opportunity arose, and the story's sort of a long shaggy dog story, but the fact is that Leon Panetta was chair of the Budget Committee and had the opportunity to be able to amend some legislation going through to include designation of the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary, which, interestingly enough, goes from San Luis Obispo to San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And it's called the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary because Leon Panetta represented the Monterey Bay.
Right.
It doesn't have some other name. But anyway, that is, it is, has a couple of pieces. One, it's federal. Number two, it is not a highly regulatory designation. It is a, there are certain activities, extractive uses, you simply can't do in these sanctuaries. So, for example, offshore oil and gas drilling. So Leon Panetta really brought effectively an end to that in the sanctuary. But it is largely an educational and informational designation, and they undertake projects like the state of California does. So it is a cooperative relationship between the state and the federal government. Folks who work in the sanctuary world are very careful to say that it is not designed to be a regulatory entity. It is designed to be a cooperative entity that manages towards the same thing. That it's fair for you to ask this because it is also about sustainability in the marine environment.
Right.
But it relies a lot on specific projects to do that, like whale disentanglement, changes of fishing gear, ropeless fishing gear using GPS, et cetera, to make sure that things are progressing in this very positive way in the oceans when the oceans are under extraordinary stress.
Can I ask a quick question, too? You mentioned that oil extraction was part of one of the things that was banned with getting the sanctuary designation. Are there any other key things like that that it's also protected against because of that designation?
Well, it is the essentially the extractive mineral, gas and mineral rights were for all intents and purposes extinguished. And or made so difficult as to be extinguished. So that provides a very high level of protection there. The other activities are really of a marine science nature. So that's where the carrot and the stick, and the stick was, thou shalt not drill here. The carrots are, let's figure out for the marine, the ocean-using community. And what I mean by that is a scientist uses the ocean, and we have a, no surprise to you folks, we have what now rivals Woods Hole and MIT in Massachusetts. We have now become essentially the richest in terms of density of marine science research institutes of world-class nature in the world. And that starts with, you start up at CSU Humboldt, and they have the Teloniker Center. We have Long Marine Lab. We have that whole consortium out there where the lab is with Fish and Wildlife and NOAA and all of those folks. Then you move down, you have Moss Landing Marine Lab, which is connected to the CSU system. Then, of course, the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute, Monterey Bay Aquarium itself, Hopkins Marine Lab connected to Stanford. We have arguably the greatest concentration of marine science minds in the world around the crest of the Monterey Bay. They use the ocean. So do commercial fishers. So do whale watching cruises. Sam Farr and Leon Panetta were at something the other night and made a really good point. We've gone from in the 1800s when killing whales was the idea. Let's get them, bring them ashore, use their blubber for oil, use their, on and on and on, to now a very big part of our marine economy, anyway, is whale watching, and the entities are no longer, the management strategy is no longer how many whales can we take. It's how many can we disentangle from this or that. How many can we, provide, make sure that their feeding grounds are as healthy as possible, et cetera. I thought that was a really good point.
A better time to be a whale.
It's actually, so I wanted to sort of intervene that, the reason whale oil was became less of a commodity was the discovery of petroleum in Pennsylvania, which made kerosene possible. So that will take us to the question of oil, although, Brooke, you had one other question, right?
No, I think I got it.
You and I sort of agreed we would talk about oil and oceans because of the spill off Huntington Beach a few weeks ago, right? Which riveted everyone's attention once again to offshore oil drilling. But in 2015, there was another Santa Barbara oil spill, and these things seem to happen rather regularly. Is it possible to do something about oil spills off the California coast?
Another sanctuary?
Yeah. Really.
Well, the platforms have been grandfathered, right? I mean, that's the That's my understanding, right? You can't, right now, you can't do any new oil drilling, exploration or oil drilling, but those that are there are there.
So they are there, and they are entrained essentially towards decommissioning.
Oh.
And so what's happening is there's a schedule. This is way inside baseball. Like, yeah, but yes, but the state of California regulates that. It does it through the Oil and Gas Division of the Department of Conservation, which is attached to the Resources Agency, which our current state senator, John Laird, he was the resources secretary for Governor Brown for 8 years and did a great job on this issue, and that is that they put together a schedule of decommissioning those, which it goes through several pieces. First part is to stop the drilling. Then you take down everything that's above the ocean. And then there's a real question about whether you'd leave that portion that you could take and cut off about 100 feet below the surface, because those have become reefs for, they are great areas at this time. Ever since then, they build natural reefs built around these,
right.
And they really, really great for that purpose, provided you stop doing your oil drilling and you do everything else. In the Huntington Beach example, I think is very illustrative of what the current challenge is, and that is, think about it. We're in the 21st century. We all saw on our handheld devices actual scenes from a robot in Mars, right? On your handheld device that I'm using to talk to you right now.
Right.
And yet, what happened in Huntington Beach? A ship's anchor, thousands of years old technology, dragged across a pipeline, hundreds of years of technology, old. This is what they were doing in the 1800s. What are you talking about? So an anchor, a 1,000-year-old technology, goes across a 200-year technology and spills oil on the coast of California in 2021? Good Lord.
Mm-hmm.
Come on. I mean, if that irony doesn't sort of strike you to action, I don't know what would. it's unconscionable to me that is permissible. Now, the accidents can happen with anchors and chains and seagoing vessels and all this business. I understand that. But to no better protect from having an oil spill, but to have basically a rickety old pipeline on the seabed, we can and have to do better than that. So the good news is that the regulatory environment, which is the purview of the California legislature and the governor, can require instantaneously that within a matter of 1, 2, or 3 years that there is no such thing as a pipe that's on the seabed floor.
You're listening to Sustainability Now. Our guest is Fred Keeley, and we're not going to go through his whole biography again, but let's just say that Fred seems to have served in every public office around here except dog catcher since the 1980s and is extraordinarily... You're still planning on that one, right? Is extraordinarily well-versed in political matters, particularly local political matters.
I just wanted to get a sense from what you're talking about. So you described a sort of phased out schedule for the offshore drilling that has been grandfathered in, right? I'm just curious, do you have a sense of what sort of, like, given, you know, now another oil spill, is there a sort of best case scenario of that phase out happening really soon? Like, when could be our last time of having to worry about this? And then is there a worst case scenario, like whatever is actually on the books right now?
My recollection of the schedule, and please don't hold me to this, and I would suggest people go to the California Department of Conservation, Oil and Gas Division regulatory webpage and check for themselves. My recollection of it is that the schedule has, I think, under 20 years, it will all be gone. It will all be decommissioned. In terms of accelerating it, I think politically the easier goal to accomplish, rather than trying to accelerate that, because that's a fight with the people who own the drilling platforms and the oil and all the rest of it, and that isn't going to get fixed in a year or two or three. I think a better place to go is the regulatory side with regard to the pipelines they use to move the gas and oil from the from the platform on shore. That distance there is the critical. That's the infrastructure failure. You don't really have blowouts of these on the California coast. That's a long ago, far away kind of thing. The technology they use now, you're not going to have the Blue Horizon or kind of problem in California. The problem is not in the extraction side. It's in the poor condition of the pipes from the platform that transmits the oil to the onshore facilities that then start doing some of the refining.
That reminds me of something happening on land with electricity. This transportation issue, distribution lines.
Well, it's infrastructure, but it is interesting that the companies have basically, not taken care of their infrastructure and transferring the costs of accidents to the public. So why don't we shift landward for a moment? And this might be a hot potato. But in your view, what should the state and Gavin Newsom do about oil wells and fracking, given the state's commitments to reducing carbon emissions?
I think that state public policy, so let's take Gavin Newsom and the legislature. I'm going to set them aside for a second. I'll be glad to return to set them aside for a second. I think good public policy in California is... California's current public policy regarding a series of activities and policies and laws and regulations and so on, which will, over the course of the next 15 years, California's air is already cleaner today than it was 10 years ago, and 10 years ago it was cleaner than it was 10 years before that.
Yeah.
All of the trajectory is in the right direction. Water quality, lots of the trajectories are in the right direction. And so then the issues around fossil-based fuels and so on, the policies that are being set are all trending in the right direction, is my sense. Now, let's go over to where the work still needs to be done, and you've raised the issue, Ronnie, and Brooke, of fracking. The future is not there. That's not where the future is. And so to invest now, for the state to see investments of that rather than in the clean fuel technology world, that's not the right play for California to go there. I think what you will see over the... I don't think you'll see this in 22 or 23, but when Governor Newsom is safely reelected and has got maybe one more year under his belt, and so now we're looking in the 24 time frame, I'll give you my prediction is probably no better or worse than anybody else's. I think you'll see the governor making a real serious play for ending fracking in California. Now, I think that could be accelerated possibly if what the governor wants to do is see some way to make a play either for the United States Senate or wants to get into the presidential sweepstakes.
Yeah.
I think you could see the governor running with that at an earlier stage. Mm. I don't think that's impossible. But I do think the Gavin administration number two, that I do think this issue will be addressed. And I think there's a lot of votes in the legislature to do that. Now, having said that, let me tell you this. Every time the Democratic caucus gets bigger in the Assembly, or the Democratic caucus gets bigger in the Senate, it gets more moderate. The reason for that is, so for example, when I was in the Assembly, it's an 80-member body. You need 41 as a majority, but you need 54 on budget, and anything that really counts takes a two-thirds vote.
Yeah.
Well, when I was there, we had 45, 46, 47 Democrats. We clearly had the majority, but we didn't have two-thirds. Now, there are 61 Democrats in the Assembly. Remember, I'm talking 43, 4, 5, 6, 7. I'm in the 40s.
Yeah.
When I'm now, it has 61 Democrats. Now, it didn't get more progressive because every one of those was turning a Republican to a Democratic district.
Right.
Almost all of those were in the Central Valley. Almost all of those members who came are persons of color, because the Valley is getting younger and browner every day, and so is their representation. And so the caucus got bigger, but it got more moderate. So on important environmental issues, those issues also have to be absolutely tied to jobs.
Right.
Jobs and the economy, jobs and the economy, jobs and the economy. And you tie, and that's not a stretch. That's a real common sense. Almost every major environmental gain that we've had in this state has come when the issue of the economy and the environment come to see common purpose and common cause with each other. The Coastal Act was that way, because the entire coast, the economy that's on the coast is coastal dependent. And and 70% of our population lives within a 1.5-hour drive of the coast of California.
Yeah, it's a narrow state.
And they are tied. The economy is tied. The healthier the ocean, the healthier the environment, the better the coastal economy is. And every time you have a chance to do that, those come together symbiotically, then you see huge environmental progress being made. The Coastal Act, CEQA.
Yeah.
I mean, we can go issue by issue.
Well, Fred,
so I think that's where you get on fracking. That's where I think the sweet spot is on fracking.
Let's talk about electricity.
Okay.
All right. There would be no oil spills if our grid were 100% renewable, if the state were 100% renewable. During your third term in the Assembly, you were chief operating officer, and you were handed the responsibility for dealing with the 2001 electricity crisis brought on by deregulation. Could you explain what happened and whether it matters today?
The short version of a very, very long story is that in the late 1990s, California was in a recession, the country was in a recession, the world was in a recession, and Governor Pete Wilson was looking for a way to move beyond the recession, and he had heard that then Prime Minister Maggie Thatcher had deregulated the electricity sector of their energy portfolio. So he sent some folks over there to take a look at it and came back, and they said, well, this is a good idea. And the governor advanced the notion, as did the legislature, the democratically controlled legislature at the time, that if what you did was treated electricity as a commodity, the theory went, you could reduce the price of electricity in the market by 40%. So just pause on that for a second. You're the governor of California, you're in a recession, businesses are hurting, individuals are hurting, and you think you have an opportunity to reduce electricity costs by 40%. That sounds like a really good outcome if you could achieve it. So Governor Wilson and the legislature engaged in a process to deregulate electricity. The next year, I got elected to the legislature. 4 years later, in the process of deregulation, the deregulation collapsed. And there was a lot of debate about why. Why were we having rolling brownouts and blackouts? Initially, there was an effort to say, aha, the reason there's brownouts and blackouts in California is because we haven't built enough power plants. We've added 500,000 people a year in the last 12 years, and there are 6 million more people in California now. And what has happened is we simply don't have enough electrons running through the system. Therefore, let's knock down the California Environmental Quality Act and other impediments, as they were characterized at the time, to building new power plants. And there was an effort to do a couple of those very rapidly. Keep in mind, siting of a power plant takes years, building takes years, regulation takes years. But the real problem was, had nothing to do with not having enough power plants. What it had to do with was the deregulation architecture essentially said, we'll treat energy as a commodity. And folks way smarter than me, I only had one economics class, and it was back in the 1970s, so I'm hardly an economist. But I do know that a commodities market has five features to it. Many buyers, many sellers, transparent transactions, the ability of the buyer to walk away if they don't like the price and substitute products. That's what a commodities market is. Electricity fails on at least three of those. You can't turn it into a commodities market. But the effort was to do that. The consequence of it not being possible for it to be a real commodities market occurred because when PG&E, Edison, San Diego Gas and Electric were all required to engage in this exercise, they sold off most of their generating facilities, their power plants. The most obvious one for us is the Moss Landing Power Plant. The failure was to adopt something called a power purchase agreement, which meant that PG&E could buy, once it sold the power to Duke Energy, it could buy its needs from Duke at a fixed price. They didn't have that. And so power that used to cost, electricity that used to cost 6 or 7 cents a kilowatt hour for PG&E was now being sold to PG&E for 10, 11, 12, 15 cents, 20 cents, 30 cents a kilowatt hour. And they were still a regulated utility in terms of how much they could charge customers. So they were upside down financially in the deal. It bled PG&E out. It bled, almost bled out San Diego Gas and Electric and Southern California Edison. So it was really not at all a matter of not having enough electrons. It was, perhaps unshockingly at this point, market manipulation by enormously capitalized folks like Enron and others who owned no power plants, but they were a trading floor. And that's what caused the California energy crisis. The only way to get out of it at the time was for California to become a market participant and try to buy long-term strips of electricity or long-term contracts through the Department of Water Resources out on the open electricity market. And that had the effect of taming the market and getting it under control.
The theory at the time was, right, that buying from a lot of independent producers, which is how the transfer of the facilities came about, would force the generators to compete, right, in the wholesale market. Mm-hmm. And what happened instead was that certain firms found that in times of relatively high demand, they could manipulate the market in such a way they could in effect buy electricity or agree to buy electricity, keep it off the market, and drive wholesale prices up. I mean, there's some speculation. This is the same thing that happened with those weather-related blackouts a couple of years ago, that there's still a possibility of gaming wholesale markets.
The wholesale market is a complicated market because it's in this country, what we do is the federal government can regulate the wholesale market and the interstate movement of electricity.
Right.
States have the authority to regulate the retail market in California and the intrastate movement of electricity. The theory that the wholesale market somehow was a genuinely competitive market, or that if it wasn't, which it wasn't, that the Fed could step in through the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and do something about wholesale prices that were above retail prices. Pause on that for a second. Wholesale prices were above retail prices. That's an absolute guarantee for rolling brownouts and blackouts to continue.
I remember that San Diego Gas and Electric sent some of its customers these enormous bills, and this happened in Texas too, during the freeze last winter. That, you know, where there's this open market, right? And that was basically what caused the whole thing to come to a halt, right?
Absolutely.
That's what bankrupted PG&E. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember sitting with the speaker and the governor in PG&E's headquarters on Martin Luther King holiday in, I believe it was 2001, and we were trying to have a workout plan that would not harm consumers but keep PG&E together.
Yeah.
And what I was advocating for in that meeting was a business deal in which the state would be of some assistance, but that PG&E would sell its hydro facilities to the state of California as part of the deal. It's the largest set of hydroelectric assets in the world under single ownership. And I thought that was a fair deal. They're a regulated public utility. They and the state had both made enormous mistakes on this deregulation, and if everybody was going to come out of it in a decent place, it seemed that the state owning the hydro facilities would have been a good idea, which, as we move further and further into renewable energy in the United States and in California, to me that looks better and better all the time.
Does the crisis of 2001 and the deregulation have any, you know, impact today or any effect on the electricity environment today?
The world was so different then. I think that from an electricity architecture point of view, where it doesn't parallel is the very substantial move now to renewables, which was really not present then. It was considered kind of a sweet little thing out on the skinny branches, but that it didn't really play a role. That was largely the view of the generators that used, they fueled their generation through natural gas or oil, whatever it happened to be. So it was not a renewable source per se. And there was no scale to speak of at that time. So I think that now it's awfully clear that the world in general, and California in particular, with AB 32 and SB 32, the landmark climate change greenhouse gas reduction laws in California, that there's not a real close parallel now, because the market is a completely different place, with renewables taking, I think, a very, very substantial role in that, and California making it very clear they're going forward hard, fast, not trying to fix and repair and restore a 19th century way to turn on the lights. And it's a 21st century strategy for turning on the lights that is less and less dependent upon fossil fuels, and more dependent as time moves on renewables.
But the chain still relies substantially on large renewable facilities, right? And various empty spaces, so-called empty spaces.
Well, I think that's the battle. That's the battle. You've raised a really good point. That's the battle. Some people are indifferent to whether or not, as long as PG&E was 100% renewables, some people don't have any trouble with that.
Right.
And they're going to go out and they can build these large facilities for solar, wind, etc. And that's scale is possible and so on. There's another school of thought that talks about distributed energy where, in effect, we're all little power plants ourselves. We put a solar array on our roof, and we do this and that, and we use more efficient appliances and so on. And that is a very popular notion. And PG&E, look, if you're PG&E, whether you're generating electricity through solar or you're doing it at the Moss Landing Power Plant, you have capital costs.
Right.
That you have to distribute over your ratepayer base. If everybody's a distributed generator with solar on our roofs and all the rest of it, PG&E doesn't see the business bargain in going out and building big facilities if that's where it's going. I think it's unclear where that market is going right now. We're in the early-ish stages of seeing how that plays out. The battle then for winning that will take place at the California Public Utilities Commission, because they're going to decide, what do ratepayers get for putting solar on their house? What does PG&E get for doing a big solar array? How does that work? Where is the risk going to be placed? And from PG&E's, but from regulated utilities' point of view, they shouldn't have to take much risk. That's their point of view. Their point of view is, we have an obligation.
That's the utilities that take that perspective, or the regulators?
Oh, not the regulators, the utilities.
If
I said regulators, I meant the utilities.
To clarify that.
The utilities don't like to take risk. And the reason for that is because they are required, they have an obligation to serve. They can't say to me, I'm sorry, we're not serving 121 Market Street in Santa Cruz. We're not going to do that. They have an obligation to serve. Their franchise agreement requires that. So if they have an obligation to serve and I put a solar array on my roof and they've planned on providing me with solar energy from an array out in the desert, how do they then recover that capital cost and investment?
Well,
that's that as they see it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, should pursue that a little farther. But of course, the argument is that with all of the hardening of the grid that PG&E has to do because of wildfires and other things, that rates are going to, which are already almost the highest in the country, are going to go even higher. And at some point, it makes more sense to put, to buy solar and batteries and become your own independent generator. And the more people drop off the grid, right, the more the cost is left behind on those who are still on the grid. But what about the argument that PG&E is as concerned about Wall Street as about its customers?
Well, PG&E, and having worked in the energy crisis, PG&E is an relatively outdated concept. It used to be in the generation, transmission, and distribution business, and it's an outdated concept.
Yeah.
This idea that we centrally generate, then push it out onto transmission lines, and then pull it down off the transmission lines through a distribution system, I don't see in 50 years that that model exists at all.
Really?
I have a hard time understanding why it would be. PG&E is every day finding itself closer and closer to being in the transmission and distribution business.
Well, yeah.
What a lousy business that is to be in. You've got, again, 19th century technology in the 21st century, and you at some point are going to have to harden that system, to use your word, harden the system. You're going to have to underground a lot of it. You're going to have to, all kinds of things are going to have to happen that are fabulously expensive capital outlay to go from the 19th century to the 21st century and jump over everything in between. That's going to be fabulously expensive. And there's only one source of payment of that, and that's the ratepayers. It's not like California government's going to do it and somehow not charge taxpayers, or PG&E's going to do it and not charge ratepayers. Their deal is their parent company, Pacific Gas and Electric Company, it owns a series of regulated utilities. It's not just PG&E that we think of as the retail business. Mm-hmm. They own lots of the holding company up on top, just like Edison International owns a lot, including Southern California Edison. Those companies are operated as for-profit businesses that don't have a regulated rate of return. They expect every one of their subsidiaries to hit their goal of 9.9% rate of return, but the holding company has no such regulatory limit on how much it can it can earn. So it's not very interested in money losing businesses, which the retail business is becoming more of a loser every day.
But you know, one of the things that we see is that the PUC, the California Public Utilities Commission, and various other friends of PG&E are struggling mightily to maintain that old, you know, the old model, because of fear of PG&E going bankrupt again, right? And what that might, you know, entail for customers in the states. And you just said that in 50 years this will be gone. So at some point, you know, there's going to be either the state will have to buy the system or the system will collapse.
Well, I'm a big believer in the state owning it.
Oh, okay, okay.
Big believer in that.
Well, as my colleague Kevin Bell pointed out, that the state could have gotten a bargain back in 2020.
You have to have a willing seller.
Yeah. Well, sure.
We were willing buyers. You had to have a willing seller. Yeah. Well, let me tell you why I'm a big believer in the state of California owning this. First of all, as a matter of principle, I think there are certain things that are not suitable for the profit-making business model.
Yeah.
And I happen to think that water, electricity, a couple of other things really should not necessarily be in the profit model business. Let me give you a quick example. PG&E has the opportunity. They don't have a guarantee to any rate of return. They have an opportunity to earn up to 9.9% rate of return or profit. They also pay about 14% hard costs on taxes. So if you took out 9.9% rate of return and 14% taxes, you're pretty much looking at 23% less business inputs that you have to cover through your rate base. In other words, the state could do it cheaper, a lot cheaper, not just a little bit, a lot cheaper, not because they're better or smarter or whatever. They're probably not. The people at PG&E aren't uneducated or stupid. They are very smart people, but they've got two hard business inputs that the state wouldn't have.
That's interesting.
And so if you can take 23% of the cost out at the very beginning, now you've got some room to say, well, what is our plan then as the state of California for running this system and providing in the modern era a 100% renewable system of electricity? Well, if you don't have to achieve 9.9% rate of return, you don't have to pay 14% taxes, you've got a much better business model in terms of how much it's going to cost. It's going to cost consumers a lot going forward, but it's going to cost a lot less, it seems to me, if the state of California owns it. And what I mean by that is some kind of state-created entity.
Yeah,
it's not just turning it over to the current Department of Water Resources, which does a real good job, in my estimation, on what their mission is. But we'd have to create a new entity. But you would keep all the labor contracts. You would keep all the, you know, the component parts, and go into the future with a business that is loaded with less expenses, hard expenses going forward, and a new way, a new business model for them, which embraces the notions of renewable energy, distributed generation, and the transmission and distribution system being a much more modern, effective system. I don't think PG&E can get there from here. It's very, the cost side of it is too much for them, I think, in terms of what the ratepayers would be asked to bear. I think there'd be a revolution of taxpayers. So why don't we just anticipate that and get ahead of it? Ratepayers aren't going to be happy about hardening this system and bringing it into the 21st century. But the question becomes, who can do it best at the least expense? And my sense is the state could do it better than PG&E.
Do you know of anybody who is actually thinking about what you just laid out? You know, I have been looking at a lot of the, you know, stuff coming out about solar and electricity. I don't think I've seen anybody really talking about that.
I think even talking about it is politically risky. To even talk about it. Right now, if you're the governor and the legislature, you can complain about PG&E, you can hold them up to be a problem, you can point to the PUC to, you know, get tough with them, or whatever it might be, but you don't own the problem. And going where I'm talking about going, you own the problem. And there's sometimes when you want to own a problem. I don't think that's a bad idea. Government should not run away from every problem that's posed to it.
Yeah, of course, that's been, well, maybe, you know, with the infrastructure initiatives, you know, something like that will happen.
Well, I think it's more possible today than it was last week, thanks to the Congress and the president approving the big infrastructure package. Look, I'm not going to speak poorly of a trillion-dollar plus infrastructure package, but let's get real about it. It's over 10 years, so that's $100 billion a year nationally. The California state budget is $225 billion general fund budget. So nationally, we will be spending less than half of what California's general fund budget is. We're going to spend half of that spread throughout the nation on infrastructure. I just want to get real about it. It's a big number. It's a big step. I'm very happy about it. But if people think every airport, every roadway, everything is going to be shiny new in 10 years, you're mistaken. It's not going to be. It's way better than nothing, and it's not a little thing. It's a big thing. I get it. But again, in California, we typically get a way to think about what California should get is it should get about 10%. If you do it on a per capita, we should get about 10%. Okay, so we're going to get 10% of $1 trillion over 10 years. Well, that's not going to build a new hardened grid in California. It's a contribution towards that, and I'm happy because it's your tax dollars and my federal tax dollars, and we're getting them back in California, and that's a good thing. But in terms of thinking, hey, we're going to have a brand new 21st century distribution and transmission system in California, well, relying on the federal government's just passed infrastructure package is not going to get us there. It's a contribution to it. It's a down payment on it, and that's fine. But if we really want this renewable system, and we do, why wouldn't you want it? It's one of the key features that if we don't do it, we're going to fail in terms of the climate change challenge. There's two things we have to do, and the good news is we know how to do them. Have to change the fuel type in transportation, have to change the fuel type in generating electricity. I went to school in the 1950s and early 60s in California, and there were kids in first, second, and third grade who they just wouldn't be there after a while. You know, well, what happened to little Johnny? What happened to little Susie? Oh, well, they got polio. And then when I was in fourth grade, we took the sock vaccine, which is a little green drop of sock vaccine and a sugar pill, and we had those, and then the kids didn't get polio anymore. And the thing now is, in our challenge with energy, we're not in that place. It's not that we don't know what to do or how to do it, and we have to invent it, and somebody has to discover it, and then we have to scale it and all that. We absolutely know. The good news is we know what to do, and it's all available. It's all available. And the mythology up to a few years ago that, oh, well, that's really a cute idea about these renewables, but you can't scale them. And more importantly, you have to subsidize them. It's terrible. You have to subsidize them. Well, I guess I would ask those people who think it's terrible to have to do that, if they believe that the cost of the Department of Defense in protecting the oil supply lines from the Mideast to California should be factored into the cost of a gallon of oil. Talk about needing a subsidy. So, but the fact is that things have fundamentally changed in the last 20 years, and California can and will become energy renewable independent. The issue is who's going to pay. We know who's going to pay for that. If you're called a ratepayer when you look one way, you're called a taxpayer when you look another way, you're the same person in terms of electricity and energy. And so we are all going to pay for that, and it's going to be, I think the question becomes, is the technology, it's not whether or not it's scalable and all that, it's going to be, what are the advances in technology that let us do this for the least cost to the ratepayer / taxpayer.
Okay, well, I'm afraid we're out of time. It's been great having you on the show.
Yes, it has. Thank you, Fred, for joining us.
It's been very kind of you to have me. I again apologize for being late, having enjoyed trick-or-treating downtown too long.
Yeah. For the first time in so many years, it's understandable.
Maybe we can have you back at some point.
Would love to do that. Thank you both very much, and thanks, Squid, for all the good work that you folks are doing on the station. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks much. Bye. If you'd like to listen to previous shows, you can find them at ksqd.org/sustainabilitynow and Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Pocket Casts, among other podcast sites. Thanks for listening, and thanks to all the staff and volunteers who make K-Squid your community radio station. And so, until next every other Sunday, Sustainability Now.